There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Listen up, dear listeners in the UK. There's a brand new guitar show this year, the Brighton Guitar Show. It's a one-day show happening on the 15th of July at the Brighton Racecourse, and it's going to be great. We'll be there along with loads of your favourite boutique and major brands like Two Notes Audio Engineering, Chapman Guitars, Fidelity Guitars, Thought BFX, Pedal Patch, Bright Onion Pedals, Ranger Effects, NRG Effects, Great Eastern Effects, Iverson Guitars, Kurt Mangan Strings, Mayberry, Leighton, Lemon Audio, Xander Circuitry, and loads more. What more excuse do you need to come to sunny Brighton, the birthplace of guitar nerds, than a guitar show full of guitars, pedals, effects, and accessories? Come say hi, hang out, have a beer, and check out all the cool gear with Matt, JD, and I. You might even see a few of the OG guitar nerds hosts knocking about. For tickets, visit brightonguitarshow.co.uk or check them out on social media with Brighton Guitar Show. See you there. Here at Guitar Nerds, we're big fans of iZotope software and their impressive range of plugins. And you, dear listener, get 10% off all iZotope plugins at iZotope.com with discount code NERDS10. Every Guitar Nerds podcast for well over five of its 10 years has been edited, polished, and repaired using iZotope's wonderful range of tools. From their Nectar suite to EQ, compress, and lightly add reverb to give the impression that Matt and I are in the same room, to the RX repair suite to deal with pops, clicks, and background noise. In fact, every sound sample that you hear on our podcast is mastered using iZotope's Ozone Mastering Suite, and I can even compare audio, EQ, and levels to other similar released material using iZotope's Tonal Recall. It's all very good, and believe it or not, there are a bunch of free plugins that you can try. A vinyl simulator for added character, the Ozone Imager for help visualizing your stereo mix, and a vocal doubler for added richness and depth to your vocals. Pretty neat. Check it all out at iZotope.com.
Matt, I keep forgetting to prepare the dad joke that I've got for the start, or the dad gad joke that I have ready for the start of each episode. I've been working on a few different jokes, and I know a bunch of good jokes about umbrellas, but they usually go over people's heads.
Hello. Hello, dear listener, and welcome to another episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. I am your host, Joe Brenton, joined this week for the first time in almost a month, Matthew Knight.
Oh, it's good to be back. it really doesn't feel like that long. You're like, yeah, you haven't been on like two episodes. I'm like, I'm pretty sure I haven't recorded for like a month. What's scary is I don't know where the time has gone. But I'm here now, in the present, and that's what's important.
Well, that's good. It's good that you're back, Matt, because we've got a whole bunch of things to talk about. There actually has been some exciting guitar news. Dear listener, I know we talked about, me and Brad Page last week talked about the new Squire Sonic series, but Matt and I are going to talk about that a little bit more. Maybe we'll talk about this weird Daredevil Fuzzwire, this new Dunlop Fuzzwire. I love me a wah. Exactly. We've got the Wampler Wong compressor. That seems to be sort of taking the world by storm, oddly, for a compressor. So, you know, we can talk about those things. After this episode, dear listener, Matt and I are going to be recording the Patreon exclusive episode of this podcast, where, as always, we'll be answering questions or talking around topics that have been posted on the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook.
Do join that, dear listener, if you're not already part of it, and become part of the community and suggest things for us to talk about. We've got a few options, Matt, so we'll decide maybe when we're there. But Phil Radomski is looking for the best Amplus rig pedal. He's currently torn between an IK Tonex, Strymon Iridium, the Boss IR 200. And it would be cool to talk about around that. Maybe we will, but also, you know, we talked about that sort of thing a bunch as well. Hans Ams was showing off the new Solman pedals, new two-tier Solman, pedal boards, not pedals. These super cool, very, very space-savvy, gorgeous-looking, high-tech pedal boards, dear listener.
Always trust Hans Ams for my
aesthetic
advice when it comes to gear.
Yeah, he's a man with taste. So maybe we'll talk about that. And Gavin Gates has been asking or talking about the best amplifier for home use. I mean, nothing ridiculously posh or all singing or dancing. His is a secondhand Roland Bass Cube that he loves. It does everything he needs for home use, and so I thought maybe Matt and I could talk about the our favorites in that regard. So we'll see where we get to with that. First of all, first of all though, I am literally fresh off a plane.
I know, Joe, you know I know that I've been, you know, like COVID and you know busy, but you have been so busy that you have stepped off a plane into the Guitar Nerds podcasting studio to come straight in and record this episode.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. I was away with this with my band this over the weekend, playing a festival in Copenhagen in Denmark called A Colossal Weekend, which is a cool.
Was it a colossal weekend?
It was a colossal weekend. I mean, Denmark is Copenhagen specifically is an absolutely incredible place. Have you ever been, Matt?
Sure I been. Have not.
You've not. No. Been.
So I am a person in my team at work lives near Copenhagen. Denmark, surprisingly small country, but split into many islands.
Yes.
And I'd love to get out there because I'd also like to meet up with our friend Stefan from the Pedal Zone as well, is out there. So it'd be always good to see him. But yeah, been meaning to go for a long time. So tell me about Copenhagen.
I mean, well, Copenhagen, dear listener and Matt, is an absolutely fantastic city. I do think the Danish have kind of nailed quite a few things. Like, I mean, there's a reason that all the design events happen in Copenhagen and in Denmark, and it's why, you know, Danish furniture has the reputation and the legacy that it does, and they just get everything right. It's one of those places where all the buildings look beautiful, not necessarily in the same style. They'll do these wonderful sort of classic, almost Gaudi buildings, but they'll look gorgeous. They do great sort of modern buildings that are big, cool black blocks that look as if they'll be timeless and they'll age well. Unlike when a new building gets built, you know, here in the UK, and they go, yeah, we'll shove some plastic covers on the front of it, and of course they become different colors over time and look awful. it's a well-designed city. Everything looks very nice. Lots of room, but lots of different style stuff. They've got the lovely canal, lovely little bars and old sort of rickety houses that look cool. Everything's great about it. I really love the look of it. I love the people. Very friendly, very nice. I don't like £10 pints.
It's an expensive place. Well, I think Scandinavia, those sort of areas are not historically not particularly cheap.
No. Well, they nail everything, don't they? They pay a high amount of tax, which means that their cities get looked after, and the minimum wage over there is you know almost double what it is here. So so it makes sense that everything is a little bit more expensive. But yeah, after sort of a few days being there, moving from pub to pub in between playing shows, those sort of £10 a pint really starts to rack up. But
and you sort of feel somewhat safer if it's euros, but when you're in a completely different currency and you're like, I have no idea how many
it's 80 Danish crowns to a tenner, and it's that sum is just odd enough that after a few beers it will become very difficult to work out what you're spending.
Yeah, But, yeah, I can feel that. I know that was like when I was in Norway and you're like, this costs 7,000 whatever. And you're like, that's either very good or terrible. And you just sort of have to not look at your bank statement until the day after you come back or never.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But it is lovely. This show is lovely. A Colossal Weekend is a brilliant little festival played at this lovely venue in the middle of the town called Vega, which has three venues. It has like a big room, a medium sized room, and a small room, and they have bands playing at each of these, so the people attending the festival can flip between them and see a variety of different weird avant-garde genres of music for an entire weekend.
What was the weirdest?
There was some pretty weird stuff. I can't remember the exact name, so it doesn't matter. But one of my favourite things was a band that were playing. They had a guitarist playing a Jazzmaster. Lots of time-based effects going on. Mostly he was textural. It was like lots of ambient stuff, which is right. Kind of death of Jazzmaster guitarists. It's kind of their sort of thing. So loads of delays and reverb, that sort of thing. Lots of shimmer going on. And then the other instrument was a MIDI clarinet running into a guitar pedal board, doing lots of weird moogie synth sounds that were also very ambient. But then the drummer was just playing almost whatever, changing time signatures, slowing down, being mock sloppy, and then tightening things up. It was just a very weird.
Literally playing to the beat of his own drum,
no coherence, just to the beat of his own drum, because the other instruments were being very much textural.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was great. So that was that was a lot of fun. That was great. But it's good. I had a great time playing because we flew in, which, you know, I've talked about this, dear listener, for the last few weeks. I'm very concerned about flying in. I love playing mainland Europe, but I love driving there in a band van where stuff is in the back. I don't like flying gear. I had a bad experience going to Austria, nearly a decade ago, where that, you know, we had a trashed pedal board and our guitars were all knocked in. So I was a bit concerned, but me and Tim redesigned our pedal boards to fit on Pedal Train Metro, I want to say 18, but I don't know. One of the very small sizes.
That's the one without the upper rails, right? That's just one long.
It's a flat. Yeah. A small flat board. That can maybe fit, well, with an MS3, you can get two more pedals along. So Boss MS3 and two more pedals along.
Right.
And we found we could squeeze in a couple extras for Tim at the top if we had them side on. So we managed to get those two together in one soft case, which was good. So we took that on as our carry-on and then flew our guitars. Hard cases. Hiscox hard cases.
You can't go wrong.
You can't. And don't get me wrong, there are certainly, you know, more robust hard cases out there with you know, metal sort of chassis around the actual plastic or whatever the foam and plastic material is. You know, you can get better cases in that respect, but those cases are great if they're coming off the flight and going straight onto the back of a van because they weigh a ton, whereas a Hiscox is still lightweight, easy for you to walk around with if you've got to go in and out of an airport, and they do the job. They look after your guitar, they keep it nice and safe, and both our guitars were fine, so that was great.
There you go. The thing you have to worry about the most is, will it actually get off the plane rather than
will it break?
Yeah. I know I've gone with a few people and done stuff for work, and you're always like, especially when you're taking artists out to another country for, I don't know, like workshops or whatever, and you're like, I really hope this person's like custom-made guitar like comes off the plane. Because it's not necessarily my direct problem, but I'm sort of going to have to sort it out. And that's what you always worry about.
That's it. That's exactly it. But of course, we didn't bring our amps. The venue were providing amplifiers for us. And we turned up and they had two guitar choices for Tim. Tim had the choice of an old, an orange, what were they called? The older ones, the 70s ones, the OR, I want to say 120?
Oh, yeah, OR 120.
And Tim, and the other option was a JCM 2000, or is it JTM 2000 or something?
JCM 2000. JCM. So that's the like 90s 2000. I always got confused because you had JCM 2000, mm-hmm. but they didn't they have like DSL or something? Yeah, so there were JCM 2000, DSL 100,
right.
Super lead. That's right, because I say JCM 2000 and I say dual super lead underneath.
Yeah.
I think that's like, it's not like Mark Packham's like favorite amp.
Is it?
I can't remember. I always remember like where he said that when he first started at, yeah. So that's the kind of the classic Marshall that I remember. So you've got classic gain, ultra gain, reverb, and then the EQ on the front, right?
Yeah, well,
that's like the punk rock Marshall head, that and the 4x12 and away you go.
Yes. Yeah. Is that how they think of it? I think so.
Unless I'm confusing it with, no, DSL 50. Yeah. It's the JCM 2000 DSL 50.
I see.
Yeah, that's like, I guess I would say that's probably one of their best ever selling amps.
Really? The 50? I know so little about Marshall because the only thing I ever knew about them from when I started playing guitar was that I didn't like the sound of them. So I just never followed that path.
I think the thing is, those ones, they just needed to be turned up, really. They just needed to be turned up.
It was quite a nice experience. So Tim, initially, he used to play Orange years ago. So he was like, well, I'll take the Orange, obviously. Problem is, he plays Fender amps these days. He needs an amp to be clean, and then he's creating drive off of his pedal board.
Mm.
So we set up the Orange, and then he was like, oh, yeah, it's just like a one-channel Orange amp, and that channel is, naturally, very gainy, very aggressive. And he, you know, he tried it for a minute, but bear in mind, we were relatively rushed. You know, it's a festival sound check. And he was like, I can't get a clean tone out of it. My, you know, time-based effects aren't going in an effects loop, so they're not gonna work at all. So I was like, well, we're going to have to grab that JCM. And Tim very much dislikes Marshall. He was very frightened by the amount of controls on the front of this amplifier were scary for him. But, you know, he set it on the clean channel. Turned it up and it actually sounded great. It was a really good sound, just straight into a 412. It's brilliant.
The Orange into a 412, or was it a combo?
There was just a 412 there. It wasn't even a Marshall 412. I think it was like a Randall.
Classic.
Classic Randall 412. Well, you've got to say, if you're a venue and you've got to have a 412 on there, do you want a Marshall that's going to have a cloth grill, or do you want a Randall that's got this robust, you know, sort of metal grill plate? That's going to last forever. You can't kick it in, you know, harder to spill drinks down it and it'll look rubbish, you know.
Yeah.
It's going to stand the test of time.
DSL 50 is a classic, really. Yeah, I think I'm sure.
Do you think they sound good? They've stood the test of time. They're good. I'm wondering if it's a thing I should get into now because I loved the sound of it. I just think it's. I almost always thought, oh, Mark Packham likes them. You know, it's that old school quintessential Marshall sound.
Yeah, I never liked them.
Right,
okay. But I think that's because I never really like. I don't know. I preferred the softness of a Fender amp, but
right.
Fender style amps, I guess American style amps, so 6V6 or 6L6, to me always felt brighter and I just preferred the feel
more of
them.
A rounded tone.
But then Fender's usually quite bright, but you know, if you were going to take, you know, 13, 14 year old me in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, mm-hmm. you know, you kind of had Hot Rod Deluxe or you had DSL 50. And I always thought that the Fender Hot Rod Deluxe sounded better because I preferred the clean amp and then using a distortion pedal. Right. But I think, you know, those Marshalls do come into their own with a bit of volume and a lot of gain.
Well, That, you know. Maybe that's the case. I mean, certainly Tim was using it clean. And admittedly, he doesn't often actually play clean. He has drive pedals running into it. But as a pedal platform, not that you need an amplifier with this many controls on it if you're just using it as a pedal platform, but as a pedal platform, really wasn't bad. Not bad at all.
I think, Marshall DSL, what was the one that came before? Well, I guess you had JCM 800. That was like the iconic... That was the iconic Marshall from like the 80s, I guess, 80s and 90s. That was like the high gain Marshall. So they went from, I guess, like the Plexis and that kind of 60s, 70s thing to, the JCM 800. And then I think from then into the 90s, that's when you went into DSLs.
I see.
And I'm trying to think, because looking at the front panel, I have to ask Mark. I'm pretty sure it was the DSL-50 was like the classic one. JCM definitely needed a bit more. Yeah, because the JCM on the drive channel, you have gain and volume, but the clean channel, you just had volume. I think a lot of people used to mod those. But DSL-50, do you know, I'm going off pure memory here because it's a long time since I plugged one in, but I always thought that Marshall sounded a bit plastic.
Right, I see.
And I don't think I actually liked the look of them. I didn't like the feel of the Tolex or the look of them.
They're a bit... The look is always feels a little bit Guns N' Roses-y to me. I don't know. It's sort of ponytails and sleeveless shirts. That's how Marshall amps have always felt to me. And so I've steered away from them for that reason. But I did really like that tone. And I'm not well versed on Marshall amps, so dear listener, help me out. I'd like to get a Marshall and check it out. I think maybe I've been missing a trick here. Let me know what you think I should get. I obviously don't want to buy the most expensive thing in the world because I'm just, you know, I'm going to get one for a bit and probably sell it, you know, but I'd like to try one out for a while. So help me out. Give me some advice and tips ahead, I think, rather than a combo. But you know, anything, give me some suggestions, throw suggestions at me and we'll see. Anyway, I totally lucked out at this, at the show, Matt, because, they sent us the list of gear in advance, of what was going to be there. And, at first I read the main stage, which we weren't playing. I read the main stage by mistake and it was like, you get an Ampeg SVT Classic and an 810. It was actually a choice of 810s. And I was like, I could even have
two. A choice of 810s.
Yeah,
wow.
There were a couple of different options. But I was like, oh, great. I mean, you know, an SVT Classic, you can't go wrong with that. And then I realized I've read the wrong stage. After getting all excited about the SVT, and I read the backline for our stage, and it was a TC Electronic RM or 800.
RH 450?
It was RH, isn't it? That was the thing, yeah, sort of RH something or other. And I was like, sort of an anemic sounding Class D head, and it was like with a 210. I was like, I hate 10s. And also, if you're going to have 10s, you need at least 4. So I was like, this the rig's not going to be amazing, but that's fine. Again, I can build my tone off of a pedal board and just use it as a clean pedal platform. Not a problem. I turned up and apparently the band on the main, who were playing the main stage at that time had their own rig. So they were like, so we've brought the SVT down. Great. So I got an 810 and an Ampeg SVT Classic and it sounded absolutely fantastic. Made me wonder why I've never owned an SVT Classic of my own. Such great, like so much headroom, so much gorgeous clarity, but aggression at the same time. There really is like nothing better than an SVT Classic.
And it looks super cool.
Yeah, exactly. So of course, as soon as I was, waiting for the flight to come back today, I was having a little look. Found an SVT Classic head for £950 in Hove. Collection only, so
950. Is that like not? I'm guessing that's a sort of more modern reissue one.
It's not a vintage one. No, not a vintage one, and certainly the ones that they make now are like £2,000 plus. You know, and
I just remember like selling a few of those and just like how insanely heavy they are.
Yeah. Yeah, they're two-man lift. And because of that, if you're going to gig it, you also need a flight case for it. So it's
yeah, because if anyone drops it, it will definitely just, well, the floor will break probably before the amp, but you still don't want to drop it.
No, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, well, there you go.
There you go.
Got lucky, but got Tim didn't. He got the opposite.
Yeah, he made it in the end, but it was good. It was good. So there you go. Help me out, dear listeners. Suggest Marshall heads to me. And if you see any SVT classics going anywhere for a little bit less money, then do let me know. And yeah, we'll see. You know, speaking of finding listings, Matt, of things, Levi Cooper a little while ago posted that a guy near him had posted up a Facebook, in a Facebook guitar sales group. Someone selling the complete set of all Boss pedals, including variant releases, anniversary editions, all the rare ones, all the Wazzacraft. The hunt is over. Grab the lot in one go. All working and in good condition. Collection only. $55,000.
So much money. It's difficult to work out whether that's a good deal or a terrible deal. You have to really sit down and...
every single pedal. I mean, he needed to provide more info than that, but every single stomp ever.
Well, do you know what I've found interesting following Boss Pedals recently? I haven't got it to hand, but I did see an industry pricing guide that Reverb put together.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of like, do you remember back in the day, this was years and years ago, probably like 30 years ago, but at guitar shows, people used to have like a big book and it was like, you get it now for like antiques and stuff. And it's like every guitar ever made. And then they're like estimate pricing based on the market from the previous year.
I buy the one for records every year.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
And then you still can't afford the black record by Prince. Isn't that the most expensive record ever sold?
I'm not sure. Maybe.
It's a side note. I remember reading that on Discogs. Basically, it was a record that Prince made, but had to make it to get out of a contract, made the whole thing black, and then went, no, I'm not going to bother putting it out, and only made 5 pressings.
Wow.
And they're the only pressings in existence. And yeah, I think someone bought, I think one went for insane money. But yeah, anyway, so Reverb put something together similar, but quite a lot in the book, in the lead up, they were talking about Boss pedals and the investment in some Boss pedals and how they've gone up like crazy money. Yeah. And, the one thing I've noticed is things like SP1, OD1, those two don't come up very often. They're the kind of part of the original three. You don't see as many slow gears as you used to. And I think, again, the price kind of like bottomed out, like on a lot of those, they became like too expensive. Like a year ago, or longer, quite a few years ago, CE1s were like crazy, crazy money.
It was, CE1 really had a sort of weird popularity phase, didn't it?
Everyone, but actually, you can buy a CE1 now for like 550 quid, which is not crazy. I mean, it's still expensive, it's thousands of pounds. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What I found interesting is the Boss pedals from the late 80s to mid 90s, late 90s even, the kind of like the middle period, I guess, of like Boss before.
You're sort of feeling things out.
Metalizer
and the high flanger.
Yeah,
and stuff like
maybe
that.
Like the second era, so not the original 70s ones, going into the sort of 80s, 90s before you kind of had the like, I would say the lull of the 2000s going into like the renaissance of the last like 10 years. But though the prices of those kind of like mid-tier 80s Boss pedals that people sort of forgot about, and we made quite a few of them, in some cases we didn't make that many of them, they're just going for like stupid money.
Right.
Like stupid, stupid money. And you're just like, no, this is just like crazy money. Like digital metalizers for like 350 quid. I'm sure it'll all die down, just like I saw Bad Monkeys are back at like 40 quid because everyone realised they were never going to sell theirs for like 250 quid or whatever.
No, crazy.
But I bought actually a pretty rare, Boss FT2.
What's the FT2?
The FT2 is the dynamic filter. So the first thing we had was the T-Wah, which then became the Touch-Wah.
Yes. I've wanted one of those for a while, the Touch-Wah.
So that's the really early, that was like late 70s. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of very early envelope auto wah, I guess. So two controls, and then you've got an up and down switch. I think maybe even very, very early 80s.
Yeah, I mean, it's the switch is very unusual for Boss because it's almost like a Les Paul rhythm or lead.
Yeah, it's the same switch that's on the CS1.
Right, I see.
CS2, CS1. So you've got the Touch-Wah that's 77 to 89.
Right.
But the dynamic filter came out in 86 and only lasted 2 years.
Wow. Yeah.
And I did a kind of live stream with Yoshi a couple years ago, and we were talking about various pedals, and he was talking about that. And they kind of created it at the time because they wanted to create a completely different analog wah sound. So this is the same sort of dynamic filter, but you've got a Q control, so you can adjust the kind of peak of the frequency. You've then got the cutoff frequency up or down, but it's a much more sort of deep mid-focused, like, vocals. It goes Ooh. Very low to very bright, right, in terms of an auto wah. But what's cool is that you can plug an expression pedal in. You can use it like a wah pedal that you can actually literally, like, sort of dial in. And I always just thought they sounded really cool. There's not many demos of them.
They go for a lot of money, man.
And now they're just, yeah, and I've been looking around for ages, and I think I ended up paying like $150.
I mean, that's
like relatively good condition.
Hugely under the mark. I'm looking at 279, 286, 330, and then at the top end, £623.
Yeah, that's just someone's just, I mean, actually, to be fair, it's like a mint condition in the box. But yeah, these were all analog, just filters. They just didn't last very long, but it's got a really good sound. It's got the sound that I was after from the big Moog pedal, and it does the same thing, but the big Moog pedal is just a massive Moog pedal.
Yeah.
And this has just got that very much kind of, it does the really expressive kind of lead auto wah thing, but then what it also does is the kind of, when you add gain with it, it does the kind of real like Zappa-esque like crazy auto wah thing. And I love the fact that you can plug an expression pedal in, use it like a manual wah. But
that is very cool.
I picked one of those up, and they're starting to go for crazy money, and you just see some of the other Boss stuff on, you know, Reverb, and you're just like, man, like some of the ones that you just wouldn't have thought have gone for a lot of money are starting to really, like, really pick up in value.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. There's certain ones that just, you know, they just sort of fly, and I don't know if there's a particular reason, but yeah, things like digital metallizers and those things for the 70s and 80s seem to be, I don't know if it's one person like hedging their bets and then someone pays it and then everyone's like, oh, we can all pay that much money for it. But, you know, what's crazy, if you think, on average here, just looking, Boss SYB5, you know, that was discontinued maybe 4 or 5 years ago now, still £95, and they're only like £120 new. So like Boss pedals, and on
you've
a
made
whole.
This, like Boss have made the synth, the SY1 now, which does a lot of these things.
Yeah, so you know, on the whole, you know, CS3, £80, you know.
Yeah.
They're about that sort of money new. Like Boss pedals seem to really hold their value. And there's a few of them out there that are going up in value. So yeah, to buy the whole collection, you know, there's probably a lot of ones in there you probably wouldn't want. But, you know, I'm sure there's some ones that just probably wouldn't be of any use today. I mean, I always fancied a Boss enhancer just because no one can really tell you exactly what it does. But I'm just not going to spend £100 on it.
Yeah. What is your favorite We'll call it the weird period boss pedal then.
The weird period.
You know, the time before. I feel like everything's almost standardized now. In that, boss now can look at the things that were really good from the start. You know, or when I don't know when rock and roll was becoming what it is today, and now boss can look back on that and be like, well, this worked and this didn't. And there's this, like we've just talked about, there's this weird period in sort of the 80s and 90s, things that have fallen by the wayside.
I think there's a lot of things that we tried and yet didn't take off, and now they sort of, they're super popular.
Right.
I've got a few. More recently than some of those, and this is much, much later, but I think this is always overlooked, especially compared to the kind of pedals out there, boutique ones that are doing like crazy sounds, and I think this is easily up there. Boss TE2 Terra Echo. Like,
wow.
You know, to me, that is one of the best sounding delays, and it is a total hidden gem.
I can't believe we're talking about this pedal 2 weeks in a row. This was Brad Page's. He thinks it's a hidden gem as well. It's on his pedal board. He absolutely loves it as a sort of an effects echo.
I think because
it's kind of an auto wah delay.
Yeah,
almost.
it uses multi-dimensional processing. Which basically analyzes your incoming signal and splits it in different ways and applies a different level of effects depending on, you know, things like the amount of the pitch that you're playing at, the strength of the input signal and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's pedals out there that you could pay double the money and they still don't do anything as cool as that.
Right.
But I would say if you want to go back in time a bit further, and I bought the later version of one of these recently, I guess I'll talk about the later version, but Boss PS3.
What a great pedal.
Because
you can do everything with that.
That effectively is a rainbow machine.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
From Earthquaker. And, you know, it was just, I don't know what they were thinking at the time they made that, but they basically made a really good delay and a pitch shifter and went, oh, I wonder if you can like blend the two together. And you get a pitch shifted reverse delayed signal that can collapse in on itself.
Yeah.
I don't know what anyone would have used it for in
before
1991, yeah. But you know, it does chorus. It does delays, it does really long delays, it does pitch shifting, it does pitch shifting with an expression pedal. Like, it was, I don't know if it came out, I think it probably came out slightly before, when was that, 1994? So I guess the Whammy had come out, what, in 1990?
Right.
So, I mean, there was other pitch shifting ones out there, but I think pitch shifting in a compact didn't exist necessarily, and then pitch shifting in a compact with delay.
Yeah.
It
was definitely bananas. I mean, the PS2, I also think is, I assume that's what you were going to talk about as.
Yeah, PS2 and PS3. I mean, they were very much almost exactly the same thing. And then I guess maybe, I mean, you could say something like the DF2, only because, actually, yeah, DF2 is distortion feedbacker or feedbacker distortion.
Yeah,
which is basically a DS2, but it had this feedback loop in it, so you could hold it down and it gave you a held note, like instant feedback. But it sort of made me remember that there was a sort of another hidden gem, I guess. There was a Boss pedal from around the same sort of time as the TE2, which is now discontinued, called the FB2 feedback booster.
Yeah, yeah.
They go for like £200 now.
What?
No one wanted them when they were out, and then they got discontinued, and everyone wanted one.
I remember joking about them, about like who's going to want, a pretend feedback pedal. At the time.
Yeah. And then I guess Digitech made the freak out and everyone's like, oh, this is really cool. But yeah, so you can basically you get instant feedback, but it was a really good booster. But the great thing was you could dial in the characteristic of the feedback, and it had a really good booster in it as well. And yeah, discontinued, wow. But now it goes for an average of 200 on Reverb here. It says in stock, current listings, 220 to 250.
Wow. Wow. That is, I'm going to throw the Boss HF2 high band flanger into the ring here, because the great thing about the high band flanger, and I know I appreciate that Boss sorted this out later with the what's the current one, the three, the
BF3.
The BF3
is now, I would say nearly over 20 years old.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. It's been around a long time. I mean, that's because they got it right. It's very good. What I was going to say is, because it's got the guitar in and the bass in, I appreciate they've solved this issue. But what's great about the high band flanger, the Boss HF2, is it's a flanger that applies things predominantly to your high end, keeping your low end intact, which is great if you love the sound. If you're a bass player, you want a flanger effect, but you want your fundamentals, I guess, to still stay intact and sound clear and punchy. And it is a great pedal for that. It is also in a gorgeous powder pink.
It looks very cool. Is a very, very cool color. Yeah. A very, very cool color.
What about the DSD2?
DSD2, got one of those. Delay sampler.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah, again, I guess they were sort of just trying everything at that point. So the DSD2 and the DSD3, again, very, very similar. Kind of a similar story, to DD2 to DD3. It was just a way to just kind of reintroduce it into the market with little to no change. It's basically a DD2, but it's also got a really early looper in it. That looper allows you to loop for a very short period of time, less than 1 second. What's cool with that actually is that it's got a trigger input. So if you've got a drum machine or a modular synth now with a trigger output, you run the output signal into the delay sampler and then you run the trigger in, it will loop and sample in line with that trigger input. So you can kind of get these kind of glitchy stop and start sort of delay effects, which is very cool. But actually, that is a hidden gem if you want to buy a really early Japanese Boss delay pedal without spending the money.
The big bucks on those old chips, yeah.
Indeed. Yeah, 1985. Pretty mad to think, really. But yeah, that is a very, very cool, very cool pedal. If you want to hear how it sounds, our good friend Jackson from previously Dip Switch Demos, now just Jackson Brooksby, did a very good demo on it a couple years ago, so worth checking out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, speaking of demos, Matt, over the last couple of weeks, we've been putting together a track, you and I, a demo, not just me, dear listeners, showing you guys what something that I've been sent sounds like, but Matt and I have been working together on something to show off, and we've spoken about this before a couple of times, dear listener, the Silk Tone Micronaut, which Matt bought. Like a refresher for listeners on what the Micronaut is?
Yeah, so the Silk Tone Micronaut is effectively a hand-wired 4-watt single channel but dual voiced mini amplifier, and I dare to say mini because it is small in size but very loud in power. So one EL84, but as they say, it's an amp, it's a drive, it's a preamp, it's a DI. It does clean and it does dirty. And it is a crazy, crazy good bit of kit. I use it almost every single day.
Has it become a real standard then for...
I think it's wicked. I really do think it's great. And I think for me, what's been really interesting, and the track that we'll play, all of those sounds were guitar in, and then I took the... So the difference with this is on the back, you've got a speaker output and then you've got a line output. But unlike other amps, the line output takes a tap from the power transformer, so you can use it as a drive pedal. You could use it as a kind of make gooder at the beginning of your signal chain if you wanted a valve drive to the rest of your chain. Or you can send it straight into a DAW. So what I did was plug my guitar in, took the line out, plugged it into my sort of pedal chain at the delay and reverb point, and then took the signal from that into my interface, and then just used Ableton. I just used a basic 4x12 cab model.
One that came with Ableton?
Just one that came with Ableton, wow. Yeah.
It sounded great. I did nothing to it, you know, afterwards. I've changed nothing.
I think the great thing with doing it that way, is because you've then got a master volume, as it were, in terms of your input level on your interface, you can crank the amp, because it's 4 watts is very loud. You know, it's like we always say that 50 watts isn't half as loud as 100, or 25 isn't half as loud as 50. You know, 10 watts is half as loud as 100, the way it works. So 4 watts is very loud. Obviously, you get less clean headroom, but actually the voicing switch on that, the voice one is very clean, and then voice two is a bit more driven. And all of the drive sounds are the amp just cranked into the interface, or at a slightly gainy level with a treble booster in the front.
Right.
But yeah, obviously the only thing is, if you then go guitar into your pedals into the front end, if you've got delays and reverbs, it's going to be very mushy, but that's what you might want.
Yeah.
I did want to mic it up, but I just couldn't get the volume. So I think if you had like two notes or was a tube amp expander or something that you could attenuate the volume, would obviously be good depending on the situation. But actually, I liked going straight into the DAW.
Hmm.
One of the other things I did, but not for the recording, is I run the line out into the effects loop return of my Olsen Little Hill, which is a 20 watt valve amp. So actually, if you want a clean power amp, but you want to use that as the drive channel, that works very well as well. So if you want the amp to have master volume, as it were,
yeah.
If you've got an amp with an effects loop, you could run into that, and then you've got effects loop as well. I sort of was starting to run it as a like front end to my pedal board, and then I was like, that is just ridiculous, really. But I run it as part of my stereo chain. So that and my Morgan PR12, which is like a Fender Princeton kind of thing, I run them into their own speaker, but both speakers in one 2x12 cab, and I just blend those together for like one sound. But all of the sounds on the track are recorded individually, and yeah, it's just guitar into the silk tone. I think delay sounds, I used Space Echo and Line 6 Echo Pro, and then just basically back out into the DAW. And it took me no time at all to dial in a guitar sound. And that's what I loved about it, in terms of those like raw, gritty overdrive sounds. If you think like very garagey, very kind of White Stripesy sort of thing, like old school cranked amps, but the fact that you can run it straight into an interface, just like great.
Yes. Just
absolutely great.
Yeah. It was absolutely spot on. I still think you managed to get your slightly David Gilmour-y, Pink Floyd sort of a slightly neater sustain tone out of it really well as well.
I liked running it in the... So the rhythm channels, if I remember rightly, are the second voice, so more driven. The lead part, which is okay, I sort of got a bit bored of playing lead parts and realized I can't play lead very well. it's the first channel, but I'm using a treble booster from Dan Coggins into the front end, because I wanted to show it being boosted in the front end as well as just the amp itself, because people have got pedals and they want to use pedals as well. The only thing it doesn't do is like super warm jazzy cleans. You can get a good clean sound out of it, but I find that on lower volumes it doesn't have the bottom end that you want. So once you crank it, it starts to bloom and fill out a little bit more. And I definitely find that running it into a bigger cab makes a difference as well. But I think for what it is, it's amazing. What I would love to do is have that in like almost a pedal for your pedal board, or compare it with something like the Audio Kitchen Big Trees.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
You know, yeah, and kind
that,
of have,
what a killer pedal. That,
you know, yeah, have that almost as like your front end.
Yeah.
And then you run everything into that and then back out into a sort of cleaner amp. So it's almost like the ultimate make gooder. But I think when I eventually move and kind of set things up, I think I'm actually going to have it as my DI for recording. And really? I'm just going to use that for DI for recording, because it's just so good for that.
It's a DI with a sort of rock and roll. It's a rock and roll DI rather than trying to be very clean or very warm or have that sort of Neve desk sort of thing. It's just it's a cool rock and roll DI. I mean, it's indeed, just, it's great. Let's give the track a listen, dear listener, and you can hear exactly what we're talking about. Very Space Echo there. Oh well,
Anna's a real one. Do you know what my favorite note is? Right at the end, it finishes on an E, but I played it on the lead part on my SG.
Right,
I've been really getting back into my SG, and I hit it because obviously that's tuned half a step down. I hit the first fret on the low E string, and I sort of bent it slightly, and it gave me that sort of Black Sabbath Iron Man thing, and I was that is a cool, as a way to describe it, it's almost got that sort of early Black Sabbath kind
rough
of
rough and
vibe
ready, that
to
raucous
it.
Thing, yeah, it's
yeah, absolutely.
I just thought it sounded fantastic. I thought it sounded great, as like, bearing in mind, dear listener, this is a little wooden box that you can fit on your desk, and you're not getting it. I mean, I guess you're not getting an imitation, a digital imitation of what, you know, someone is telling you, a massive stadium rig sounds like. You're just getting a great sounding valve amplifier in a really easy, you know, to use and record in the situation that we all mostly find ourselves in, which is at a desk with a small interface and a DAW.
Yeah, highly recommended. Bit different, but it's well worth checking out. Well worth checking out.
Yes, absolutely. It was super cool. Okay, so worth noting at this juncture, dear listener, last week, Brad and I spoke a bit about Rob Nordvik's discussion points. And dear listener, I'm aware that topic of the week, I haven't done one for a couple of weeks because we've had a lot of guests on and things like that. But Matt and I would really love to delve into some of Rob's topics. So next week, we're going to do just that. We're going to dedicate a lot of time to those topics. And then we'll continue spinning the wheel and getting new people for topic of the week after that. But just to let you know, that's how things are going to work moving forward. Matt, should we talk about a news item? I don't think we've got enough time for all of them. We might get a couple in. Where would you go? New things.
Where would I go? New things.
There's the Squire Sonic series. Me and Brad spoke about that a bit, dear listener. But
maybe we should talk about that next week, because I'm planning some testing with some other bits related to that. Why don't we talk about Origin Effects? Because I want to talk about Origin Effects because I also just want to give even more love back to the Revival 57, right. Which I guess is I've got the Revival Trem, but now called the Revival 57. Right. And they do the Magna 57. And I've got that on my pedal board. And it's just great. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, I actually sort of want two on my pedal board.
Yeah.
Because there's so many good sounds in it, so many good drive sounds. It's built like a tank.
I would say I that's the only shortfall on of any of the Origin stuff is like no MIDI. So you're always forced to, and I understand why. These are proper, very analog, built like tanks, designed to last pedals. It's just because they do so much, it kind of makes you wish you had some way of getting extra things out of them.
Because I use a switching, you know, like an ES8 type thing, you know. You can turn on the tremolo on and off, and you can tap in the tempo,
right?
Which I really like. You know, that makes, to me, I think that's always really nice because it does allow you to have dry, and it's just, they're just so responsive to the volume control.
Yeah.
And if you look at, you know, they call that, if you go to their website, Overdrive and Boost, you know, amp recreation, and it, to me, it does feel like an amp. It feels like a it feels like a cranked amp or just a kind of Fender amp on the edge. They actually call it Deluxe 61, just to correct myself. Magma 57 and Deluxe 61 is that. But
they've got all that push and pull, that organic feel, that sort of sagginess that you get with an amplifier. I don't know. It's just they're obviously absolute works of art. The design team, you know, go to the nth degree to make these pedals everything that they want to be. There's nothing's ever absolutely thrown out with this company. It's all perfected.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, they just launched the DCX Boost and the DCX Bass, but also recently they had the MEQ driver and the Halcyon Green Overdrive. So the Halcyon Green Overdrive is their take on a sort of Tube Screamer type thing. The MEQ driver was based on a sort of channel strip, like a Pultec Studio EQ. And then they're sort of, this DCX Boost, it's just, it's an absolutely killer boost pedal. You know, they say studio preamp with their adaptive circuitry. So you've got an EQ mode and an OD mode, and then you've got three different voices, low frequency, high frequency, level and drive on the front. And it's kind of based off a UA610 preamp, which is like a retro console preamp. But yeah, you can really push it into distortion. And I must admit, this is the kind of thing I'm looking for my pedal board at the moment. You know, something that basically doesn't give you a lot of drive, but you can put at the front of everything else. I don't want anything with too much gain, and I just think this thing sounds absolutely amazing.
Yeah,
and they just look and feel solid, don't they?
Absolutely. That is kind of the backbone of Origin Effects. I've got the Pettijohn Electronics. They've discontinued it now. They've changed their chassis. One of their old sort of very rugged, cold, hammered steel chassis with an angled foot pedal. I've got their high-quality studio channel strip inspired boost pedal, which reminds me a lot of this because you get a low and a high pass filter as well as like a level and a drive. So it's a great clean boost, but it can be used really effectively for warming up your tone as well. This reminds me of the same sort of thing, and I think of Pettijohn as being an almost similar company, or at least their older stuff was, where when they made them in those very, very sort of super rugged chassis. They've moved to a more standardized chassis now. But I love this idea, the channel strip booster, giving you more control, like amp control sort of on your pedal board via the low and high pass filter and a few voicings. I think the DCX is going to be fantastic.
Yeah, I think all of that new stuff, that the MEQ driver, the house in, they just all sound really, really good. But I think what I like about this is not just the kind of look and feel of it, but the fact that they're kind of going, well, we're not going to do a drive pedal. I mean, yes, they've done like a Tube Screamer, but everything else is sort of like, it's a bit more like studio gear on the floor, which right. I really, really like. And it's just different because, you know, not many people are going to get a chance to try the real thing. So I think it's nice to be able to kind of base a drive circuit off something like that. And that's what people were doing in the studio. They were going straight into decks. They were cranking, you know, different things and seeing what happens. So I think for me, it's kind of nice to be able to do that, I think. Yeah. And have a different type of drive pedal. Reminds me, you know, if you think about that kind of outlook, is the Walrus Audio 385.
385, still Tim's drive of choice.
Is it?
That's his always on drive. And then he uses the Redbeard Angry Rhubarb as his flavorer, you know, sort of time nice. Second drive. But yeah, 385 is always on. And that was that 385 was, and dear listener, I appreciate we've mentioned this pedal a lot on this podcast, was an overdrive by Walrus Audio that was inspired by the preamp of an old projector, an old video projector.
Mm. And the preamp in that. So, very cool indeed. So I like it when people just do something a bit different.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, we'll see. I'm going to reach out to Origin Effects, see if we can get those. Maybe I can get the bass one, you can get the guitar one, Matt, and we can make something with those pedals. We'll see what we end up doing. We are coming towards the end of the podcast. Before I go, I do want to talk about this. The Fender Tom DeLonge Starcaster.
The alien guitar.
It is obviously there's no sign that this Starcaster is going to become a standard signature model that the general public can buy. They seem to just be making models for Tom DeLonge at the moment. But this one, his new one is it's been designed by the Fender Luthier Brian Thrasher. And it is a Starcaster with his, you know, dirty fingers humbucker in the bridge as it was, but it has actual meteorite dust made as part of the finish, which reminded me of the old Steve Vai DNA where he had some.
Oh, there's so many of those. I think there was. I think there was like Joey Jordison, like Slipknot drumsticks with like blood in it. Like loads of people have done that. But definitely it's got vibes of the Steve Vai DNA guitar, which is worth crazy, crazy money now.
Yeah. Yeah. But yes, this one in particular, it has the dust has lunar, Martian, and carbonaceous meteorites. The sides and back were torched like a meteor coming through the atmosphere. That's the gist of this. So,
but just correct me if I'm wrong here, Joe, because I'm looking at his Instagram, and I'm sure the one I'm talking about isn't a Starcaster, because they do one that's like his 333 and a picture with like a red stripe down the middle. Is that a different guitar?
That might be a different guitar. There is a red stripe on his meteorite one. It's offset. I was not aware that they'd done a 333 style one, but
because there's a picture of him holding one that's got that offset red stripe mm-hmm. with the F holes, but it's got a Fender neck on it with a Fender headstock. But
that's a Starcaster.
But the picture two pictures before that on his Instagram is definitely a 333.
Well, I mean. Yeah, I don't know which picture you're specifically looking at. The ones I'm looking at, they're all offset. They're all his. I see where you've had a little look at it. I think maybe that's just his inspiration. But that is absolutely. You're completely right. That is that is his old Gibson 333, and it looks like it's been remade as a Starcaster now with the actual meteorite stuff. I know there was it caused a little bit of controversy when I posted about this on the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook, because people were like, well, it's got a stupid sticker on it. Like, you know, even if it's a cool idea, the guitar looks silly because he's put a kid sticker on it and, you know, stuff like that. I appreciate it's a little bit, you know, if you're going to do something like actual moon dust in your finish, it would have been nice if maybe it had looked a little bit more, I don't know, classic, a little bit more tasteful than this, but
he doesn't care.
He doesn't care. He's a punk guitarist. It's of course.
And he's on his golden lap. Do you know what I mean? He's completed life.
Yeah.
And then he went off and did his own thing and like followed aliens for years. And then he's come back and then everyone's like, oh yeah, Blink were rubbish and now they're good again. So
He's
on his golden lap of life, so he can do what he wants, to be honest.
I guess he can. Yeah, we're at that point. Oh, well, anyway, dear listener, we are coming to the end of this week's episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. Like I said at the start, Matt and I are going to be heading over to Patreon, patreon.com/guitar nerds. Dear listener, if you want to join us, all the information on how to do that is available on Patreon. But the gist is you can become part of our community for as little as $1 a month, and at the $5 tier, you get access to all of our additional episodes, our Patreon special episodes. We do one a week, Matt and I, or, you know, and all of our guests that we have on. So we're going to head over there, talk about some questions from the Facebook group. And we'll be back next week with more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Goodbye.
Thank you, dear Patreon supporters, for listening to another episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. Now, of course, as usual, it is time for me to thank our top tier Patreon supporters for being so amazing. Thank you to Marcus Deluxe, Suresh, Dorsonic Pickups, Chris Franklin, Anton Fryant, Russ Meehan, Barry Gresbick, Steve Davis, Daniel Walker, Jorin Brown, John Conaway, The Studio Rats, Russell Healing, Yogi the Guitarist, Ty Allen, Kyle Harris, Sean Hughes, Andy Hoffler, Eric Hemmer, Jeffrey Wax, Brian Einsler, Mark Hizau Kadawaki, Stuart Robson, Eric File, Peter Pesce, Andy Manley, Simon Milbourn, Joe Puttick, Blake Wyland, Phil Radomski, Dave Lee, Ross Edwards, Jason Wharton, James Dorr, Jake Gray, Derek Rich, Scott Kennedy, Steve Merkel, Abe Matthews, Christopher Loseth, Stephen Burke, Robin Smith, Kytopia the Band, JD Short, Andy McKenzie, Brad Page, Paul Corrigan, Rob Nordvik, Scott O'Brien, and of course, Moog Gravitt.